Right, we're going to be looking at the question of the truth of the Bible, and I want to start with a picture. Anyone tell me what it's a picture of? No? A Bible. Good, good. Okay, we're getting an advance on that. Maybe zoom in a bit. Sorry? Wycliffe Bible? No, not quite. No, not Tyndale either. No, a little bit later. It's the King James Bible. That's right. This is the original 1611 printing. So there's the whole page, and there's zoomed in. And we're actually in 2 Kings chapter 18. And I'm going to zoom in a little bit further for us to see some of this. Now, hopefully that print is big enough for you to read. It's a slightly odd script, so we're just going to need to take a little bit of time to think about that. But I'm going to read it out to you, and we're going to follow the words. Okay, now, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, yes, those are S's, believe it or not, and that's an R, I know it doesn't look like it, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. Now, fenced means walled, okay? And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, I have offended, I've done something wrong, return from me, i.e., please go away, that which thou puttest on me will I bear, which means whatever you fine me, I will pay. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. That doesn't mean he gave them, it means said, this is the fine, mate. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house. Okay? Beautiful script. Just 24 letters in the alphabet, not 26 like we have now, because I and J are the same. And also, because you can see I and J are the same, can't you? I and J are just the same, and your U and your V are just the same. So why people call it the KJV when two of those letters didn't really exist? I'm not quite sure. But anyway, so why are we here? Well, let's go on a couple of verses, and we read a bit more. And the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah, with a great host, a great army, against Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they were come up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the Fuller's Field. I love the fact they had no apostrophe back then. You know, we should get rid of those too. But here we are. So they were at the highway of the place where people wash their clothes. Now, why would I highlight that to you? Well, the interesting thing is that was printed in a Bible over 400 years ago. Now, that's interesting because it's got a number of claims in it. For instance, it claims that there was a Judean king called Hezekiah, that all the fortified cities of Judah were captured, all except for Jerusalem. This was done by a man called Sennacherib, who was king of Assyria, that Sennacherib is particularly associated with Lachish, a fort against it, and Hezekiah was fined 30 talents of gold, 300 talents of silver, and that it says in response, Hezekiah gave all of the silver that was in the king's house and temple, which is interesting, because did that, all of it, just neatly correspond with 300 talents of silver, or did he give a different sum? That's the question we have. Now, next, Napoleon Bonaparte. Obvious link. Why would I show Napoleon Bonaparte at a Christian conference? Well, simply this. He's the guy who is said to have begun archaeology. I mean, there's a slight debate, but we'll give Boney the credit, shall we? That he took experts round with his army when he went into Egypt around 1798. So we're talking about 200 years ago archaeology began, 400 years ago we got a printed Bible. And you would be able, without having to do too much work, to be able to get hold of a 300 or 400-year-old Bible, printed Bible. I mean, you know, they're around. Sometimes families have them. One of those old Bibles. Now, interesting, because that printed Bible was made at a time when there was no archaeology, which means that any knowledge that printed Bible has or displays of the past can only come by being handed down through manuscripts from the past. It can't come because of people reading monuments. In fact, it wasn't until after archaeology began that they deciphered ancient Egyptian, 1822, the Rosetta Stone, go and see the British Museum. The 1840s, they decipher ancient Assyrian records and ancient Persian. So in other words, we've got our Christians 300-400 years ago reading old Bibles, and none of those Bibles can have any input from archaeological knowledge, right? They've only had stuff that's been handed down over time. Well, just think about what a period of time that is. How much could have changed? What could have been altered? But the funny thing is, archaeology begins. People dig things out of the ground and they begin deciphering ancient records. And they find, if you asked your man who read the Bible 400 years ago, can you name the Assyrian kings in the Bible? Well, if they did a bit of study, they'd be able to name you five Assyrian kings, and they'd be able to put four of them in chronological order, and one of them, because he's only mentioned in Isaiah, in a rough place, but they wouldn't be certain. So they put them in a particular order. And then Akkadian is deciphered from the 1840s onwards, and people start finding the monuments of these people. And I like to use Wikipedia because, not because it's such an authoritative source, but because it's actually founded by an atheist. And so I actually think there's an anti-Christian bias in parts of Wikipedia. So Wikipedia is really good if you want to look up somewhere to go and see that's sunny, you know, and it'll give you all the details of what's there, right? But if you want to know something on a key issue of the faith, it tends to be anti-Christian. Which means, however, whenever they agree with the Bible, they're doing so because they've had their arm twisted, you see what I mean, by the facts. And so the fact that I can look up Wikipedia and actually get a picture of one of the ancient kings mentioned in the Bible, Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, Sennacherib, and Esarhaddon, where in many cases the writings of these people themselves have survived. And they're in that right chronological order. Now think about that. My Bible reader from 300-400 years ago has got things that have got historical information from a long time earlier. In fact, it's not just that you have Assyrian kings mentioned in the Bible, you also have Bible kings mentioned in Assyrian records. So here we have a whole list of kings of Israel, kings of Judah, and where they get mentioned. So this is to get an international mention, right? You have to have a certain prominence, and so it's quite striking that you get that going on. Now you could go to this museum, and British Museum, lovely place, and I would really strongly recommend that red book on the bookstall, the 1750, is it? Or maybe £15 for going round the British Museum, the evidence for that, really, there is so much in there. And you can go and see rooms like this where you have the cartoons or propaganda from the palace walls of all that he did. And you could zoom in and you can see actually the cartoon scenes of Lachish being besieged. Now, what you have is, because they didn't have animation back then, they had sort of go through scenes from left to right. These are shields of the people going up. These are Judeans being impaled. Here's, you know, arrows and all sorts of things going on. But basically, he recorded the same event as we have in the books of Kings, of the siege of Lachish. And we can know quite a lot about that. Or you'd also find in the British Museum, you'd find the Taylor Prism. There are three copies of this prism, one in London, where Sennacherib himself wrote his own account of what he did to Jerusalem. And this is what he says. And I want us to look at this because it's really remarkable. As for Hezekiah the Judean, I besieged 46 of his fortified walled cities. Notice it's almost the same expression as you get in the Bible. Fenced or walled cities. I conquered them and took out 200,150 people. He himself I locked up within Jerusalem, his royal city, like a bird in a cage. Now this is what is now called spin. I'll explain it. If you don't capture a city, you don't sort of say, and I didn't capture the city, I was defeated. You say, I shut him up like a bird in a cage. Puts a very much more positive spin on it from Sennacherib's perspective. Of course, he didn't get into the cage or get the bird out. And then it says, Hezekiah was overwhelmed by the splendor of my lordliness and sent me 30 talents of gold, 800 talents of silver. Now, isn't that fascinating? Because what we remember from the Bible is the Bible said that he was fined 30 talents of gold, 300 talents of silver, and that he gave all of the silver which was in his house and the Lord's house. Very interesting. Now, I am utterly struck by the fact that they have the same number, 30 talents of gold in each. I am more struck by that than that they have different numbers on the silver. Because I don't know of any ancient record with that much detail, that sort of small detail which is confirmed over such a period of time. This is an amazing thing. So if you asked your Bible reader in England 300 years ago, how much gold did Sennacherib fine Hezekiah, they would have said 30 talents of gold. And you then read these monuments from 700 BC confirming that this is in fact what went on. That to me is amazing, because think how easy it is to miscopy numbers. I mean, numbers, you know, you can miscopy very easily. If any scribe had miscopied those in the whole of the history of the transmission of the Bible, well, we wouldn't have got the right number, would you? You know, how would you correct a number once it's been wrongly copied? It's remarkable. And in terms of the difference on the silver, well, of course you could say that this text is right and that one's wrong, or that one's wrong and this one's right, and so on. Or you could say, you know, they could both be right, because actually one's talking about the fine that was imposed and the other one's talking about the actual sum that was paid. But let's go back to this text where it talks about Tartan and Rabsaris again. When they decipher Assyrian, they actually start making dictionaries. In fact, this is the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary. Just the letter T has two volumes, because there are two different sorts of T. And here we look up our man Tartanu, and we find, ooh, that's the ancient Assyrian word for second in command. And Rab, of course, a bit like rabbi, big chief, overseer. So these are really interesting things, because that language had been forgotten. Now, again, that means the Hebrew scribes who copied the Old Testament have to be copying a language which has died out correctly. You know, they've got to do it correctly, because actually foreign words are easier to make mistakes with. And if you don't know the language, how are you going to know to spell it correctly? But in fact, it's spelled perfectly, and so the language is deciphered. Now, just to give another detail from two chapters later, of course, the detail that Hezekiah actually made a pool and a conduit of water, and then you can go to Jerusalem today and see the Siloam Tunnel discovered in the 19th century. Remarkable waterworks. You could even, if you go between about 1700 and 1800, you find that Bibles like to have dates in. So here's a date in the margin, and I'll just blow that up. It says the fall of Samaria, 721 BC. And that's in 1785, before archaeology began. Now, that number doesn't come from the Bible itself. It's got Bible information put into it, but it's not a biblical date, you understand? Well, nowadays, after all of the archaeology that's happened, we now think it's probably 722. That's not bad, is it, really? You know, so someone before archaeology getting that sort of accurate detail, you can see here's, just to give you that blow up bit of Wikipedia, you can see the word 722. For that when he invaded Canaan. Not bad, really. So what's so surprising? Well, the surprising thing is this. The King James Version is based on a printed Old Testament from 1525. That printed Old Testament has no access to no Hebrew manuscripts from before the year 1100, which means that if we're dealing with information from 700 BC, we have 1,800 years of copying in which things can go wrong. Now, that is remarkable, because it means that overall in that generation, if anyone miscopied it, or if the people who wrote down the story in the first place wrote it down wrong, there's no way people like Isaac Newton and others would be able to calculate dates in the Old Testament so accurately. There's just no way they'd be able to do it. It's remarkable. Tiglath-Pileser's dates now, 727, we used to think it was, people 300 years ago thought it was 729. Not bad. So what we find is amazing transmission over time. Now, a lot of people say, can you prove to me the Bible hasn't been miscopied? And the answer is, of course I can't prove that. That's asking me to prove a negative. You can't prove negatives. I can't prove that there isn't a disappearing pink elephant in the toilets that disappears every time you go in there. Can't prove it. Don't believe there is one, right? Proving that something hasn't changed. Impossible. Imagine you had a photo of Moses coming down the mountain with the tablets. What would be to prove he hadn't changed it just before he came round the corner? You know what I mean? If I am to go down that route of proving to a skeptic that someone hasn't changed, that's ridiculous. But that's not how we live our lives, is it? Think about it. You watch a sports program on the TV. You watch a match. Can you really prove to yourself that you're seeing the same thing as your neighbor next door. You know, I mean, how do you know? We know there's great technology nowadays. Someone could be doing computer generation to make it look a bit different on your screen, so actually you see something different from your neighbor. Do you feel you need to check that up and run both side by side on two screens to check there are no differences? Well, although we know that people have the technology to forge all sorts of things on photo nowadays, we also know they'd need massive budgets to do so. So we think they probably didn't. It's exactly the same with forging Bible manuscripts. Look, if a Bible manuscript's written on leather, leather comes from animals. How many animal skins do I need for a Bible? Think about that. Work it out. It's probably going to be several hundred animals for a complete Bible, isn't it? So think about the price of that, the fact that it's going to take you the best part of a year to copy a Bible out. It's quite a financial investment. You know, if we just think of it in today's terms, what's it going to cost you to falsify a Bible? Well, I don't know what you're paid, but you sort of work out your annual salary, you work out the price of the animals. It starts clocking up, doesn't it? It's quite a few tens of thousands to falsify one Bible. And that just gives you one, and it doesn't give you any daughter, descendants of that copy. So, in fact, our culture is more dependent on copying than any previous culture, because when we speak to people on our phones, you know, we don't actually hear their voice. We hear a copy of their voice. Not a copy of their voice, a copy of a copy of their voice. In fact, a copy of a copy of a copy of a many times copy of their voice. That's how it gets out. And we're really, really confident. We base our lives on it. We get on aeroplanes because of it. We accept jobs. Some people accept jobs the other side of the world based on what people, you know, this copying process, where they believe they've actually heard someone's voice, offer them a job. You know, all sorts of things. We trust all the time based on copying. Contracts come through fax or whatever it is. We believe the copying. So why are we believing and copying all the time in all of our business contracts, dealings, and somehow we're super skeptical when it comes to the Bible? See, that is what shows us the bias in the human heart. So I'm not interested in proving to you the Bible hasn't changed. I'm interested in doing two things. One is showing there's no reason to think it has changed. Secondly, there are lots of reasons to think it hasn't. That's enough. The other thing is that what's happened is 400 years ago, their earliest manuscripts were, you know, for the New Testament, about 1200 AD, right? Now, they're before 200 AD. So in other words, the gap between the New Testament and the manuscripts was over 1,000 years, and it's gradually been getting less and less and less. And people still say, but what happened before our earliest copy? But come on, we're going to get more and more early copies. You're going to say, what happened before the earliest ones? What's happened is just as the gap of evidence has been getting smaller and smaller, our society has been getting more and more skeptical about the Bible, showing that there is no correlation between the amount of evidence you have and the amount of skepticism people have. They're just, you know, on different planets. You see what I mean? Nowadays, people say, you are guilty, Bible, until proven innocent. You see? So that's one of the things we need to consider very carefully. It's a remarkable thing that so much has been confirmed over time. But you say, but can we go any earlier than that? Well, yeah, I'll show you this bearded man. And you, if you go to the British Museum, you might well see him walking around. He is a great scholar, one of the greatest scholars of cuneiform tablets there is, Irving Finkel. And a few years ago, he was handed this 60-line ancient Babylonian tablet, dated in standard dating to 1750 BC. So we're talking about something which is one of the earliest pieces of literature ever to survive. And this is what he says when he tries to read it. What gave me the biggest shock in 44 years of grappling with difficult lines of cuneiform tablets was, however, what came next. This is a tablet about the flood. My best shot at the first two signs, beginning line 52, came up with sha and na, both incompletely preserved. On looking unhopefully for words in beginning shana in the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, I showed you a picture, section sha, part one, sha to shap, I found the following entry and nearly fell off my chair as a result of the words. Sha na or sha na, adverb, two each, two by two, OA, stands for Old Akkadian. And he suddenly realized that he was reading a story of the flood, which is one of the earliest records to survive in physical terms, and it's talking about animals going in two by two. And he wrote a book about this. Now, actually, his book has got some problems in it because he's trying to argue that the ark was originally round. I think he's wrong on that. But what he shows is, firstly, that's a bit of the story, which up until he discovered that tablet, a lot of skeptics would say, that came up 1,000 years later. Well, we're finding, remember our 17th century Christians would have said, well, the animals went into the ark 2x2, and now that bit of story has gone back, how many 100 years? Well, it's gone back 3,400 years in dating. You wouldn't have thought, was it really that much old? Yeah. The other thing he showed is he has this round ark, which is wrong, but he looks at its floor area, and the floor area of the round ark, and the Babylonians also, other stories, had a cubic ark, not very good for seasickness. And he said, but it's only 4% different in its floor area from Noah's ark. So it's a really remarkable thing that you get these sort of details handed down over time. So I'd want to ask you, which is the most advanced of these things? Is it the modern mobile phone? Is it the scribe writing on leather? Or is it the ancient clay tablet which you have to get wet clay and you incise in it? Well, probably you'd say the mobile phone. I mean, we can send things over a great distance over time, we can research, we can get so much detailed information. And you're probably going to say, well, the leather's quite advanced because, if you only have 22 signs to write in Hebrew and it's more portable, yeah, that's a bit better than the Babylonian tablet. But then you ask yourself the question, which lasts longest? How many of you are using a mobile phone that you're using 5 years ago? Bless you. 10 years ago. No one. So, Babylonian tablets last for a lot longer. Paper lasts for longer than a phone. So when you're asking, okay, which is the most advanced? Oh, you go for the electronic. When you ask for longevity, actually, the clay. Now, I think what's happening is discrimination against the Old Testament on the ground that it was written on a perishable material, namely leather or papyrus. And guess what? Perishable materials don't last. But it's because it was a more, in some ways, advanced civilization. It was a copying-based civilization. So people go to their museums today and they say, aha, Babylonian tablet, really, really old. They go to the museums and they don't put the Bibles in the museum. They think it's not so old. Actually, there's going to be a wonderful museum of the Bible. I've got a friend here in Washington from who's going to helping set up a big museum in Washington, D.C., so you can talk to Michael afterwards about that. It's very exciting. But people don't generally put Bibles in museums. They don't think they're so old, but they are. What's in it? Which contains the oldest text? Well, that's an interesting thing, because actually I could have an older text on my mobile phone than the Babylonian tablet, because I can have all sorts of things and pictures on it. So what you've got to distinguish is between the material things are made of and the age of the writing. And I want to say, from what we can tell, the age of the writing in the Bible is very, very old. Now, we could go on to a bit of argument for the New Testament, but I might just pause and say, have we got any questions lined up yet? Or should I go on to an argument for the New Testament? I'm going to keep going. Okay, I just want to give you one argument for the New Testament, and this is the resurrection. Resurrection's really cool. I'm sure most of you believe in it. That's great. But I want to try and give you a different approach on this. When you read the resurrection accounts, you see that Matthew and John are very different. Matthew, you would think it goes like this. Women go to the tomb. They see an angel who's already scared the guards and who's sitting on top of the gravestone. They go along, shows them round. They run off. And they meet Jesus. John, however, is a bit different because Mary goes to the tomb, still dark, doesn't go in, runs back to the disciples and says, we, so there's more to the story than just what meets the eye, we don't know where they've laid him. They've rolled. Then a couple of the disciples run off. They look inside, see nothing. They go off. Mary somehow is back there again. It doesn't explain how she got back there. She looks into the tomb, has a conversation with the angels, or the men in white. Angels are men, usually. Yeah. I mean, as in... don't go there. Just angels don't necessarily have wings, okay? So there's one verse in Daniel 9 you could read as saying that Gabriel flew. That may be the case, but Superman flew without wings. No, the idea that angels have to have wings, cherubs and seraphim clearly have wings. It's not clear to me that angels all have wings. So when you get the clue in the Gospels, men wearing bright clothing, you think, yeah, okay, it's an angel. Angel means messenger. And then Mary turns around and she sees the gardener, who's actually Jesus. See, it looks like very different accounts. You think, how can you fit them together? Well, there are many ways you can fit them together. But what I want you to notice is that the resurrection accounts agree on the really big things, namely that Jesus was raised from the dead, women first at the tomb, those sort of things. Then they have some pretty significant differences at the medium level of detail. But I want to point out to you that they have these tiny agreements. For instance, though Matthew and John are very different, Matthew says that when they met Jesus, they came and took hold of his feet. Mary, but John tells you, Jesus says to Mary, do not cling on to me. It never says that he clung on to her, she clung on to him. It just said, don't do it. So you can see that from two different angles, they're actually agreeing on the physical contact. Then the next thing Jesus says, in one case, in Matthew, do not be afraid, go and tell my brothers to go into Galilee. That's unusual to refer to his disciples as brothers. There they will see me. Similarly, you get it in John. But go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Now, how do you have a brother by having, well, you know, in this case, the same father? Well, that's what it means. It's really striking because, again, Jesus doesn't normally talk of his disciples as brothers. So you get exactly what you would expect if you have independent accounts. They agree on the big things. There are some pretty differences on the medium top sorts of things because independent accounts just do that. Doesn't mean they're not true. Just means that they're coming at things from different angles. But then they agree on these tiny things, which is exactly what you'd expect. When I used to prosecute plagiarism and working in the University of Aberdeen, I used to call them in at 9 a.m. after a sleepless night and, you know, ask them about how their essay was so similar to someone else's or just so similar to some printed work. And, you know, they would start off on their story. And, you know, when there were truth tellers, there were hallmarks of truth, little details that they are so sophisticated. You think, look, if anyone is able to make up these details, they don't need to plagiarize, you know. So I'd want to say you've got exactly that going on with the resurrection accounts. Josephus said, when he talked of witness, he said, let not the witness of women be accepted because of the lightheadedness and insolence of their kind. Josephus, the Jewish writer, not in the Bible. But what I want to show, he's a first century Jewish writer showing the attitudes that people had towards female witnesses. Why would someone making up a story have women as the first witnesses? But then we find, if I were making up the story of the resurrection, I would give Jesus a star role. He does have the star role. But I would give him the bright, dazzling clothing. But what we find is that in all four Gospels, we have references to the men in white or the angels in white and how dazzling their clothing was, and nothing about Jesus' clothing. What? I mean, he should have, you know, main actor, they're accompanying parts. What on earth do you have? But you have, despite all the differences, this is actually the way it's described. So it's a sort of eyewitness detail that you would expect. Another strange thing in all the accounts, reference to doubt. Matthew, you know, you'd think, Matthew, you need to take some writing lessons because he's building up to the climax. I mean, it's wonderful. I love Matthew. But he's building up to the climax of his gospel, the Great Commission, four verses before he's getting to the climax. He says, they saw him, they worshipped, but some doubted. And I say, Matthew, why did you put in that bit about doubt? You're really spoiling the ending. You know, seeing Jesus and doubting. You would have thought that if you saw Jesus, it ended all doubt, wouldn't you? But actually, people see Jesus and doubt. Luke's gospel, Jesus appears to them and he says, why do doubts appear in your minds? You know, he says to Thomas, stop doubting. Why do you need to tell people who are looking at you to stop doubting? Precisely this, because Jews back then believed that there would be a resurrection of all people at the end of time, or maybe of God's people at the end of time, but not of one out of sequence with the rest, right? That's impossible, which means if you've seen Jesus killed and you see a Jesus lookalike, There are various possibilities which are not resurrections, like God sending a lookalike angel, but not that Jesus has come back from the dead, you see? So in that sense, yes, they had doubt. Surprising thing if you're trying to persuade people of its truth, isn't it? And then we look at the variety of resurrection appearances where Jesus appears to groups of men, groups of women, groups ranging from 200 to 500, indoors, outdoors, in the country, in the town, up a hill, by a lake, morning, evening, by prior appointment, without prior appointment, always standing, sitting, talking, all three positions, always there's conversation, always back and forth conversation. It's amazing. Now, you could explain an empty tomb by having some people rob a body. What you'd want to take the body for is a question, but you could sort of do it. But that won't explain the variety of people who report that they've seen Jesus risen from the dead. That requires a lot of people to say they've seen Jesus risen from the dead. And this isn't seeing someone at a particular angle at a particular time of day or thinking you see some statue crying or something like this. This is close-up interaction. It's amazing that you have this. And it's those two arguments together that give you a powerful argument for the resurrection. It's the convergence of the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances. But I want to give you a further argument that locks it in. And that is that this doesn't just happen to anyone. It actually happens to someone very, very special. It happens to someone who also, there are many independent things we can say about Jesus. For instance, he was already famous by the time of the resurrection. That's part of the whole scene. Even on secular grounds, people acknowledge that there was a big disturbance in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. He was already believed to be Messiah. That seems to be, even secular historians say, why he was crucified. So you think about that. That means he was already believed to be the person who was the promised redeemer of one of the most remarkable people groups in the entire history of the earth. That's not just any old position. So to have that with the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances is remarkable. But there are also more miracles reported of him than of anyone else of that time. He's believed to have performed miracles. He was believed at that stage already to have royal line genealogy, be born in Bethlehem. And by sheer coincidence, he died at Passover, the time of the greatest deliverance of the Jews. Amazing. All of those coincidences on one person. And after a while, don't you say, you know, how many can we take? I don't read Chinese, but it looks pretty. Confucius says, what you do not want yourself, do not force onto others. One rabbi, a generation before Jesus, said, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow. Jesus put it positively. Whatever you wish that others would do for you, do also unto them. Now, someone might say, well, how do we know Jesus said that? Well, either he said it, or he had amazing disciples who came up with some of the best ideas in the world and then attributed them to him. Either way, that's a remarkable thing about Jesus. You know, lucky to have such great disciples. I want to give you one more coincidence to look at, which is of a thoroughly different kind. And this is, you work out when Jesus was crucified based on the fact that he died when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea. Gives you from the year 26 to 36. He died on a Friday. And he has to die at Passover time, which makes it 14th or 15th of Nisan. Even the Jewish texts say they hung him on the eve of Passover. Someone that Stephen knows very well wrote a book about the date of the crucifixion. I'm not entirely convinced of all of his arguments, but he did do this very basic thing that you say, where have you got Fridays, which are also in Passover time during this period? And he says, basically, you've got the year 30 and you've got the year 33. And he says, between these two, the year 33 is the more probable because it reports that John the Baptist began his ministry in the 15th year of Tiberius's reign, and that is more commonly thought to be the year 29. From John, you know, he has to have a three-year ministry, at least because of the number of festivals. And also, it explains Pilate was politically weakened in the year 31. That explains why he really has to please the rulers, the Jewish rulers. And so he says the most likely date for the crucifixion is April the 3rd, AD 33. Now, I'm not telling you something from the Bible. I'm telling you something outside the Bible. Maybe wrong. But it's interesting that in the Bible, when Peter preaches his sermon at Pentecost, it says this. He quotes Joel, which says, "The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the day of the Lord." And one of the things you see there, reference to a darkness, and there is an external reference to darkness from outside the Bible, but also this thing about the moon being turned to blood. And when you calculate April the 3rd, AD 33, it's actually a lunar eclipse night. Everyone's sitting down for their Passover meal between 6:20 and 11 p.m. to within 20 minutes error, they actually see the moon go blood red. It's quite a remarkable thing. So you have all these different sorts of independent coincidences happening with Jesus. And that's only really been known since the year 1983. So what I want to say is that some people don't like miracles because they spoil a pattern. And I just want to say all the miracles in the Bible make a pattern. They make a pattern to, relating to Jesus. And so what we have is not lots of random things going on, but the best, the strongest arguments we have converge on the fact that we have so many things pointing to Jesus. I'm going to do some more things that point to Jesus in the final talk. But for me, the argument for the resurrection is not just the empty tomb and just the empty tomb and the resurrection appearances. It's those two plus everything else remarkable about Jesus. And you put all of those together and you say, look, if you want to deny all that, you have to be doing some very big intellectual leaps to try and get around it. So I think we'll end just there.